Tonight on Arena, Sophie Ellis-Bextor on Songs from a Kitchen Disco, the album, and Fergus Shiel asks and answers, where do I begin with Richard Strauss? #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. A basic income scheme for the arts and culture sector was discussed by ministers at Cabinet today. A report from the government's Arts and Culture Recovery Task Force presented to the Cabinet by Minister for Arts, Catherine Martin, today calls for a basic income scheme to be introduced to the sector. Join us now is our arts and media correspondent, Sinead Crowley, to tell us more. We heard Minister Catherine Martin on Drive Time earlier on, Sinead. And earlier today, we were talking about, 55,000 workers could benefit from this new scheme. It seems it might be a lot less than that now.
Well, they don't have a breakdown in the task force of exactly how many, but what they have said in the report today is that at the moment, just over 7,000 people are claiming the PUP in the category arts, entertainment and recreation, and that includes sports. So I would imagine when the minister earlier was talking about thousands rather than multiples of thousands, I imagine that's one of the things they're looking at. So if you say less than 7,000 people altogether are claiming PUP, then I would imagine they are the type of people that they would be putting on to this payment, because this payment is, if it comes to pass, will be a social welfare payment like the PUP. It'll just be directed at people working in the arts, and it's there to maintain them and to maintain them as artists while we get through what we're going through at the moment.
And I suppose really what this is, it gives a real ray of hope, I guess, to lots of people in the sector, given the difficult period there, like many other sectors, but I think in particular the live entertainment sector, which has been devastated by this pandemic, this gives them some hope.
Exactly. And I mean, it's nearly become a cliche at this stage, but it was said again today, they were the first to go and possibly the last to come back. And I think what it does is it both offers hope in terms of the payment, but it also sends out a message that their work has been taken very seriously, because, you know, these are people who are very highly trained, whether they're artists or whether they're the people who support the artists, like the lighting or the sound or whatever. They're very highly trained in that industry. And the suggestion of just, you know, going off and getting another job or working in another sector mightn't necessarily be realistic for them. So here's a payment that says, look, we respect what you do and we think that we need to have you when all this is over. So this is designed to keep them afloat. And they're talking about a 3-year pilot scheme. I mean, hopefully some people wouldn't need to be on this for 3 years, for example. You are allowed to earn at the same time. So the plan would be that it literally, as Claire Dignan, who's the chair of the task force, said at the press conference, puts a floor under them so that they have this to just keep them going in the short term. And then they can start to look around and say, well, what can I do? You know, it might be the case, hopefully, that maybe outdoor gigs will come back first, or performances. You know, there's also mention in the task force, for example, of bolstering the outdoor cultural spaces so that is more possible. I think the theory is we'll all be sipping coffee and listening to music outdoors a long time before we do it indoors, you know. So the plan would be that these people would have this payment, they'd get it through these long dark winter days, and then as things start to open up, you do get to earn more money, you pay tax and the other money, and then hopefully the plan would be they would come off it then, because they're jobs will be back.
I guess, and that sounds as if it's more of a, is it more of a long-term plan in terms of a basic income for the arts sector, or in fact for all sectors, using the arts sector as a kind of a pilot case? Is it more of a long-term plan than it is a direct response to the pandemic?
There is an element of that. It was apparently in discussion even before, and Minister Martin made reference to a not dissimilar scheme in France, which has apparently been running since the 1930s to support artists. So yes, I think that was seen as well, that look, if this, obviously it was brought forward by the pandemic, and unfortunately, you know, that's why we're discussing it today, but at the same time it is seen as a pilot scheme, you know, directed at one sector who really needed it at the moment. And yeah, absolutely, that the plan would be they would look to see how it would work out.
And it's not just, I mean, obviously the big headline was, here comes this tax-free payment for people. And the specifics of that, I guess, will be worked out in time through the period of the pilot scheme. But there were a lot of other areas of support that were suggested within the report as well.
Yeah, there were, and they're very interesting. And as you say, I suppose not all of them will be gone into in depth because that was the headline figure. But one that really caught my eye was recommendation 8, which is making space for arts and live entertainment to contribute to national recovery. And that's making the point that obviously at the moment the levels are quite broad, in that if a cultural space is closed under a certain level, that's all cultural spaces, whether you're a gig venue or a museum. But this makes the point that, you know, some venues, galleries, cinemas offer large areas with ample circulation and controlled spaces, and that it might be possible, you know, for people to go into, for example, a museum a lot quicker than they would another smaller or less well-ventilated cultural space. And it's also making the point that these can actually aid national recovery, because essentially having galleries open are good for people. You know, they're good to have it as a space. They're good to have them there. So the plan would be that the levels would be re-examined, the living with COVID level would be re-examined to maybe allow for some more cultural spaces to open a bit earlier than was thought. And I know there'd be huge welcome for that in the culture industry. For example, we all know of, you know, say galleries again, or museums, that they're big spaces, they're well controlled, they can have the hand sanitizers, they can have people, you know, spacing them out. And so I think they would really welcome the opportunity to prove that they can open.
Minister Martin earlier in the programme also was talking about the value of the arts. I mean, this is something that we've heard many, many times. Oh, what the arts have given to us and how they've supported us through this difficult time. What about those who actually gave this report to the Minister? She said on Drive Time earlier on that, you know, she gave them what they asked for. I presume there has there been universal welcome? Have there been any dissenting voices?
Now, pretty much universal welcome, you know. And I think what's very interesting is the fact that the task force was so broad, because you had artists on the task force as well. You had Martin Hayes on there, you had Denise Chyla there from Limerick, you had the National Campaign for the Arts on there, you had the audiovisual industry, you know. So really, they asked people with expertise in the industry to come forward. And I think that you can see that in the welcome. The people were inside the tent, essentially, and they were offering this advice. And so this is where it's coming from. And in fairness to the task force, they only started meeting in September, so it was a fairly big job, you know, all meetings on Zoom to get all of these voices together and get this report. And here we are in mid-November. But I think that shows you, I suppose, just how passionate people are about protecting this. And again, it's this sense that it's not just about a payment here or an opening there. It's this sense of actually valuing the sector and saying, look, it's not just about getting through the winter. It's about, we want you there when all this is over, because we want to go. We all do want to go back to gigs and want to go back to museums and want that artistic life. And if they're not supported, I suppose the worry is that they won't be there. And that seems to be the thrust of this report.
All right. That's Sinead Crowley, our arts and media correspondent. Thanks for that, Sinead. And that brings us to 12 minutes past seven. 7 full months we are now into our lives being overturned by pandemic, and much of the country, in fact, much of the world, I guess, is getting fed up staring at the walls of the house. But if that's the case, you could do worse than follow the example of disco superstar Sophie Ellis-Bextor. Turn the four walls of your own house into something resembling a set from Saturday Night Fever in 1977. Now, you'll need all of the costumes to go with that, of course. In March of this year, Sophie began hosting Instagram videos of herself tearing up her own kitchen floor in glorious sequined outfits surrounded by her 5 sons, performing some of the finest party music from her career. That has become, it was called at the time, Songs from a Kitchen Disco. The Instagram posts, the album is on the way. And we'll talk to Sophie Ellis-Bextor about it in a moment. But first of all, let's give you a chance, if you're at home, whether it's in the kitchen or the dining room or the sitting room or even the bedroom, why don't you have some murder on the dance floor?
It's murder on the dance floor, but you better not kill the groove, DJ. Gonna burn this goddamn house right down. Oh, I know about your kind. And so and so and so and so and so and so and so, I'll have to
put down the matches, Sophie Ellis-Bextor. Don't burn the house down just yet. Murder on the dance floor. I'm delighted to have Sophie Ellis-Bextor join us this evening. Tell me, Sophie, that you are and were dancing to that, and that you're wearing some glorious sequined outfit in honour of our radio programme this evening.
I do. I have some twinkles on, actually. Yeah. It's funny because I kind of got into a habit a few days ago of getting a bit, like, just dressing in the same sort of jeans and T-shirt and jumper all the time. And I thought, enough of this. Come on. So yeah, I sort of went back to my more sparkly garments. It does lift your mood, you know, definitely.
Oh, well, it certainly does. I mean, unfortunately, we had we broadcast 5 nights a week. So on Friday night, we normally have our album reviews, and I know, and 7 o'clock. So the half six thing, your Friday night half six, was a slight problem for me in that respect. Even though I enjoyed a little bit of chair dancing to that particular event there. Had you any idea when you started, what I guess was just a bit of fun in the kitchen initially, that it would go the way it went?
Golly, no, not at all. And don't worry, you can still catch up, you know. They're all on my Instagram. There's no excuse to not watch me try and not tread on my baby for 10 weeks of discos. No, I mean, golly, we started the discos because, like everybody else, we felt really weird at the beginning of lockdown and we didn't know what to do. And the house was a bit tense and, you know, we were all a bit freaked out by the news and the news was very heavy. So we did what we do as a family, which is, you know, put some music on. And Richard said, my husband, he said, why don't we just do it as an Instagram gig? And I thought, that's the craziest idea ever. Like, why not? Okay, fine. And I thought people were going to laugh at me, actually, because I put on a sequin catsuit and it felt a bit ridiculous. But I think, you know, it just was a bit of fun and a bit silly. And there's not been a lot of that this year. So I guess it was a place for people to come and join in with us and, you know, check what the kids were wearing that week. We did lots of fancy dress outfits. We've done loads of covers. And we did a Halloween one recently. And the same thing happened for me with my emotions, which is that it's such a tonic. I get a real lift. I'm doing these discos. It makes me feel really good. I love singing different songs. I love having some fun with the kids. And I love seeing people. It's like having a little community. It's really nice.
And obviously you love referring to some of your favourite pieces of literature as well, which links into a favourite song. Let's have a listen to, I'm not even going to say what the song is. You can introduce it. Here it is, like I have you introducing it from the podcast, which of course, not the podcast, the Instagram post, which is, as you say, still available on your Instagram post. But let's have a listen to a well-known song and how you introduce it.
My kids all wanted me to do the Addams Family, but I'm really selfish. And I wanted to sing a song about two lovers where they kind of, he was a bad, brooding, angry man. She was from posh society. She ended up dying a tragic early death. And she comes back as a ghost to rap at his window and say, Heathcliff, let me back in. So the ghost of Kathy remains. That's right, Nikki.
Baxter, if somebody's told me that they were going to sing Wuthering Heights in their kitchen, I'd say that's a really good idea. Sing it in your kitchen and don't attempt to let anybody else hear you singing it. Were you out of your mind when you chose that? Because, I mean, obviously the Kate Bush version is so, you know, everybody knows it. It's so amazing. You do a brilliant job on it there yourself. Were you anxious about that, picking that song?
In all honesty, if I was going to sing that song like live on TV or something, I'd probably be really nervous. But, you know, obviously what you can't see on the radio is the fact that while I'm singing that, I'm dressed as a sort of vampire person. I'm singing to my 11-year-old son, Kit, who had on at the time a bear mask and he's wearing a black cape. You know, it makes no sense to be too nervous when it's so ridiculous, right? It's just a bit fun. What's the worst that can happen, you know? I sing it badly. It doesn't really matter. Yeah, it's done to make a bit of fun.
And was that what they... Because, you know, the new album is essentially, for the most part, it's cover versions or new versions of some of your own songs. Was that what singing in the kitchen, what discos from the kitchen floor allowed you to do, or, sorry, songs from kitchen disco allowed you to do, maybe approach songs that, as you said, if it was a live TV show or if it was a big arena performance, you'd say, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, definitely. I think that was a massive part. I mean, The Songs from the Kitchen Disco album is actually all the singles of mine that I sang during that, and then a little sprinkling of some of my favourite covers from the Kitchen Disco. But, you know, choosing covers is a joy. And during, you know, the long, monotonous weeks of lockdown where it was all domesticity and not much else, it was really nice for my head to be learning the lyrics to a song I didn't know that well, but one that I've always loved. So I just would kind of cast my net far and wide and think, right, what do I want to do this week? And initially I was only singing songs in the main disco that were kind of upbeat party classics, but then I kind of selfishly created for myself something called the after party, where I could be really outlandish and it wasn't my responsibility to get people dancing. So that led to things like Wuthering Heights, like a few of my favorite things by Julie Andrews, like Get Off by Prince, just anything I felt like, just literally inside of my head stuff. It's really fun.
I've read on several occasions where you say that your five sons willingly participated. Is that true, or was there a lot of either ice cream or time on the Xbox given? If you do this, I'll allow you to do X or Y or Z.
Actually, it's not even quite as clever as that, really. And I wouldn't say they participated willingly. Basically, I was very chilled about it. And every week I just say, we're going to do a kitchen tonight if you fancy it. Sometimes I get the full compliment. Sometimes I get two or three. Sometimes they'd be really into it and then they get bored and just sit in the background looking really fed up for ages. Sometimes they'd start fighting. Sometimes they try and jump off the furniture. they were just kids.
Yeah, I was going to say, so they behaved like a family. They behaved like a family.
Yeah. They just saw their mum singing into the back of their dad's phone. They had no idea anyone was watching. They just thought it was me going a bit potty as usual. It's fine.
So now what happens when you... Because the plan is, obviously, we have the album, which is what we're talking about in some ways this evening, but you're planning to bring it out on tour. That's a big wardrobe you're going to have to carry with you, I'm guessing. Will there be a very visual side to any potential stage show?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the tour idea came before the album because... Mm. Halfway through the kitchen discos and lockdown, I realized, you know, normal life wasn't going to continue as it left off for a very long time. And also that what we'd been doing had been really significant to me and meant a lot. And I thought I'd love to find a way to bring this into the daylight, you know, into my day job. So I thought I'll do it live. So basically we plan on creating the atmosphere and indeed the look of our kitchen, which is fine. I know what that looks like. It's a little bit surreal to be building it and taking it to theatres, but fine. And then I just want to make it fun for people. I take it really seriously when people buy tickets to my gigs anyway. So my job is to leave them with more of a spring in the step than when they arrived. I want to get them dancing. I want to make people feel good. We really need that. I know I do.
Yeah, so yeah, I have to say, you are bringing everything with you on this tour, including the kitchen sink then. That's the story, is it?
Yes, but not my children.
You're leaving them at home.
I'm crazy, but not that crazy.
I think you heard a little bit of our discussion just at the top of the programme about arts funding and this idea that's been mooted here at the moment about a basic income scheme for the arts and culture sector, partly as a way out of COVID, but maybe as a longer-term plan as well. The response of the British government, you were very angry about one particular ad, they think, that an ad campaign that was out there. What was that ad campaign?
So the British government have done a couple of things that have upset people, I would say, in the live events industry. Firstly, talking about retraining. And secondly, yes, they did an advert that showed a ballerina. It said, this is, you know, Fatima, I can't remember what the wording was now. It was something like, Fatima's going to be working in computer science. She just doesn't know it yet, which is wrong on so many levels. But I think, you know, I really felt it on behalf of my friends and colleagues I've worked with for a very long time. I've been doing what I do for 20 years. And actually, I've spent a lot of that time working with the same people. So these are people who've built up decades and decades of experience and employable skills so that they can do the thing they love, you know, lighting a show, mixing the sound, you know, helping with equipment on stage, whatever it may be. And everybody understands if there's a pandemic that they need to do what they can to make ends meet until they can return to their jobs. There's a very big difference between, you know, getting by to the next bit and actually retraining. So I think that made just so many people feel that they weren't seen, and kind of goes back to this slight stereotype of musicians and crew, like we were sort of lucky to be doing the thing we loved in the first place and now it's time to get a proper job. And I speak to these people all the time. I can hear their voices turn from just feeling a little bit anxious about the future to feeling frightened and feeling, angry, because they feel like they've fallen off a radar, like there's a big hole in the arts and they're just expected to fill it themselves.
Yeah, well, lest we forget it, there was talk at one time here as well about retraining, and I think it was stopped very quickly when they realised what, you know, how insulting it is effectively to artists to say, look, go off now and get yourself a real job. I know you've been doing that for 25 years and I know that you've been giving us a lot of solace during lockdown, but cop yourself on was essentially what it felt like. I presume that's what you felt too.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, if there's certain aspects of the arts that have been allowed to keep going, like radio, for example, but how would someone who worked in radio, that's a radio engineer, feel if they were asked to just retrain? It's the same thing. It's just because live events are the things that are affected. But, you know, these are real skills. They're not people who are just sort of chancing it. They do a job that is really hard to do, and they've got loads of experience doing it. So I just think it was very insensitive, really.
Certainly was that. Let's finish up with another of the tracks from the album, Sophie. I'll let you choose. Do you want to hear your 2020 version of Groove Jet, or do you want to go crying at the discotheque?
Ah, you know what? I've heard Crying at Discotheque a lot recently. I've been singing it. So maybe I'll go with Groove Jet, actually. It'd be nice to hear that.
Glad you chose that. That was what I wanted to. Listen, lovely to have spoken
you
with
you.
Thanks a million.
You too. Take care.
Yeah, take care. That's Sophie Alice Baxter there, speaking to us about her new album, Songs from the Kitchen Disco. And let's go out with the opening track from the album, Classic. Originally recorded in 2001, but reworked. If this ain't a Groove Jet, if this ain't love, 2020. Groove Jet, If This Ain't Love, the 2020 version, and that from Sophie Ellis Baxter's new album, Songs from the Kitchen Disco. Best known for his operas, Der Rosenkavalier and Salome, Richard Strauss was a leading German composer of the late Romantic and early modern era, born in Munich in 1864. He grew up around music. His father, in fact, was the principal horn player in the city's court opera. And along with fellow composer Gustav Mahler, his work is considered to represent the late flowering of German Romanticism. Delighted to be joined this evening by the artistic director of Irish National Opera, Fergus Scheel. And rather than asking you, Fergus, where do I begin with the work of Richard Strauss, I suppose I should ask you, where did you begin with Richard Strauss? A very specific and special memory for you here, Fergus.
That's right, Sean. Good evening to you and to all the listeners. Yeah, I mean, Richard Strauss is one of these names I knew when I was younger, but I suppose I didn't fully grasp that he wasn't a relation of Johann Strauss and all the waltz people from Vienna. No relation at all, and his music is very different. When I was in college in Trinity studying music, I remember a lecturer put on a recording of the second of the four last songs, which were written in 1948, just right at the end of Strauss's life. And I remember just being totally mesmerized and perplexed by it, because it was so complex and so luscious and so voluptuous. It was like you were immersed in a chocolate factory or something. It was so beautiful, and almost like I couldn't believe that music could be that beautiful. You know, when you have one of those experiences that redefines for you exactly what the possibilities are. And that beautiful recording with Jesse Norman singing so beautifully, it really transfigured me. And I've loved Strauss's music ever since.
And in fact, it's the second, as you say, of the four last songs that we're going to hear this evening. Spring is the first, When Falling Asleep is the third, and At Sunset is the fourth. September is the one that you've chosen. I guess even that title, the fact that we're in September, gives us a kind of an autumnal feel to what Strauss was at here.
Exactly, and this is it was from the very end of his life, as I said, and obviously the imminence of death is something that is just over his shoulder, as it were, and it rears its head in many of the songs, but he's quite at peace with it. What you have in this is you have a lifetime of experience. It's like he's packed everything that he's ever learned throughout his entire life into it. And I would urge, if your listeners, if we're going to play a little bit, turn up the volume, listen really carefully to like everything that's happening. It's like a whole dense forest of activity that's happening under that beautiful voice.
Mm-hmm. voice of Jesse Norman there with the Gewandhaus Orchestra of Leipzig, conducted by Kurt Mazur, and the second of the four last songs of Richard Strauss. Fergus Scheel choosing some pieces from Strauss for us to start with, to get us to get to whet our appetites to listen to more. He really, Strauss really knows how to orchestrate the music, doesn't he? Like, there's so much happening there.
It's pure chocolate or velvet or something. It's so rich and beautiful.
Lockdown, then, that was that particular recording, in fact, I think, as you said, as you told us, was very much your starting point with Richard Strauss. Lockdown sent you back to the composer.
Well, yes, what I realised was that I only know a small fraction of his music very well. And, in you know, he's a major figure, particularly of opera, and I work in opera, as you mentioned. Mm. And it occurred to me that, you know, I've really only come across one or two of his operas. I've only worked on one myself, personally, and I've seen them internationally, but in Ireland, you don't come across them so much. And I'm thinking about what we want to do and how we could maybe program some of his operas in the future. But I decided it was time for me to learn a little bit more. So I did something I've never done before. So I put all of his music, every single piece he wrote, onto a Spotify playlist. And I started at the beginning and went through it over months and months and months. And I listened to it. I was walking every day, and listened to it on my noise-cancelling headphones, and immersed myself in an hour or an hour and a half of his music every day, and went right from the beginning to the end. It took about 6 months to do it.
But that's it. So you actually started at Opus One and worked your way through the entire body of work. That must have given you an incredible overview of how the music develops.
Yeah, and you know, he was a composer for 80 years. He began writing music when he was 6, and he wrote his last piece when he was 85 or 84. So, you know, it's an enormous body of work, and you can hear it developing and growing over the years, and you can hear how he goes in and out of particular phases where he's only writing opera, or phases where he's writing more orchestral music. And right at the end of his life, when he wrote quite a number of orchestral pieces, you get a feeling for all that. But I think the one thing that really struck me most of all is the voice. It's a human voice. Yeah. You know, he's written lots of orchestral material, but it's just the operas, it's the beauty of the voice, it's his leader. He's written so many songs as well. And many of the songs he wrote for piano, and he subsequently orchestrated as well, so they exist in a number of versions. And they're just the most spectacular music, and his particular love of the voice, particularly the female voice.
Well, let's go to, you mentioned one that he wrote maybe for piano and voice, and then subsequently orchestrated, the version we have of Morgan or Morning, featuring Elisabeth Schwarzkopf. What particularly struck you about this recording, Fergus?
Well, of course, Schwarzkopf is an absolutely top Strauss singer. I think the song itself is just so beautiful, because you'll hear on this now, it begins with a solo violin it sounds almost like a violin concerto to begin. And then after a moment or so, the voice comes in almost subservient to the violin at first, and then takes over. And the text begins with the word "and." It's "and tomorrow the sun will shine again." It's like the singer comes in the middle of a sentence, and it's this beauty and the love of the two people at the centre of this song. And there's also that kind of tinge of maybe something has gone wrong and they're having a reconciliation, and that they've decided to give their relationship one more go. At least that's how I read the text. That might be my own view of it, but it's this beauty and the morning and the and the couple on the beach looking at the blue sky, and the beauty of the orchestration is incredible.
Thank you.
so incredibly beautiful. Morgan, the Richard Strauss song, their Morning, sung by Elizabeth Shorpskov. And it was the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra there, conducted by Georges Sel. Fergus Scheele choosing the music for us this evening for Where Do I Begin With? I mean, he's asking us or advising us on where to begin with Richard Strauss. You mentioned Shorpskov before we listened to that, Fergus, as having the perfect Strauss voice. What is the perfect Strauss voice?
Well, I think with Strauss, it's very much it's about clarity. It's about diction and the text, and using the text to help shape the music. And also, I think she had a large enough voice because some of his orchestration is huge. So in that song, you can hear she's not particularly, she doesn't have to sing terribly loud, but she can when she needs to, and she can, she has the personality and the voice to adapt to larger contexts. His operas, I mean, the reason his operas are not performed so much here in particular is they are absolutely enormous. If you take something like the Rosenkavalier, for example, there's 26 singing roles in it and 7 silent roles and a chorus as well, and orchestra and offstage orchestra. It's just enormous. Yeah. And it's like the world, it's capturing all the emotions of the world. And so it's quite a prospect.
Yeah, so you said that maybe in terms of Irish National Opera, you'd be thinking about working towards a Strauss opera. Would it be Der Rosenkavalier, yes. Yeah?
That's very high on the wish list, absolutely. And partly because, Strauss had this absolute affinity for female voices, and there's something in the water in Ireland that we have so many fantastic female singers. So I can think of lots of people who would do wonderful performances of the three. There's three very major female roles in the Rosenkavalier. So it's very much on the cards. Hopefully it won't take too long to bring it about.
Yeah, I shouldn't ask you who the three people are, because what if one of them doesn't?
Oh, no, I'll be shot.
Yeah, exactly. So I won't do that. I look forward to talking to you about it when it does come to pass. But I'm going to have to finish up with, we've had two pieces featuring voices. So let's go to the purely instrumental side of Strauss as well. I suppose most people will know this back, Zarathustra from Space Odyssey 2001. Yes. But you've actually chosen a piece called Metamorphosen for 23 strings. And that sounds as if it's 23 instruments, but there's something else going on here really, isn't there, Fergus?
Well, normally if you had a string orchestra of 23 players, they'd be playing maybe 4 different lines for five, first violin, second viola, cello, bass. But here all 23 players have their own line. So it's like, almost like 6 string quartets playing together. And so there's that density again, which I've mentioned before in relation to the 4 last songs. And this is also a late piece. It comes from towards the end of his life. In fact, he wrote it towards the end of the Second World War, when he was completely despondent about Germany and about the path that the country had taken, and 2,000 years of civilization had been wiped out by the barbarians. And so he was very, he was very upset and despondent at the time. And he poured all his grief into this piece. And it's a heartbreaking piece. Again, I'd encourage people to listen with the volume up. It's not particularly loud, but when you listen up loud, you can hear all the density of what's going on and all the different lines pulling at each other. It's like all the 23 instruments have their own idea of what should happen, and they all pull against each other and create this amazing world, which I find so exciting.
Well, thanks for opening up that world to us just a little bit this evening. That's Fergus Scheele there, giving us some wonderful advice on where to start with Richard Strauss. And let's listen to some of that Metamorphosen for 23 strings, the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. It's well worth seeking that out and listening to the entire work. In fact, all of the entire works that that Fergus Scheele suggested to us this evening. That was the Metamorphosen for 23 strings, the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. And it was Fergus Scheele, Artistic Director of Irish National Opera, who this evening helped us to answer that question. Where do I begin with Richard Strauss? The Dublin Book Festival begins next Thursday, November the 26th, and I'm delighted to say that on Friday, the 27th, Arena is centre stage at the festival here on Radio 1, simultaneously on the dublinbookfestival.com website and on rte.ie/culture. We'll be talking to three of our literary greats. Roddy Doyle will tell us about his new book, Love. We'll also hear from Kevin Barry about his new collection of short stories, That Old Country Music, and the current One City, One Book author, Christine Dwyer Hickey, revisits her breakthrough novel, Tatty. We'll also have music from Uli, and it's all coming from the beautiful surrounds of Molly, the Museum of Literature Ireland. You can listen on Radio 1, 7 p.m. or watch online dublinbookfestival.com. I want to whet your appetite for the event in two ways. The first is a reading from Roddy Doyle from the novel Love. You've heard me speaking about it in recent weeks. His new novel, the story of two school pals, Dave and Joe, who meet up later in life, go for a pub crawl in Dublin. Copious pints are consumed. They recall their shared youth and their loves and the events that have shaped their lives since. Now, in the passage we're about to hear, Joe tells Dave about his ex-wife, Trish, and how merged their life experiences and stories that they tell about their life experiences have become. And there's a little bit of language in the midst of this, and it's Roddy Doyle who's reading.
We were all out there, sitting around in a big circle like, and Trish starts telling a story, something that happened when the kids were smaller, a few years before, another couple of years back. There's a school at the end of our road, do you remember? No, I said. I'd never been to his house. Ah, you do. I don't. Well, there is, he said, on the corner, a girls' school, the National, you know. And if you're trying to get out off the road when all the parents are dropping their kids off in the morning just before 9, you haven't a hope. It's jammed. It's a pain in the arse. So anyway, Trish was telling everyone about this one time. The car, our car, like, was stuck behind a Jeep. The woman driving the Jeep had parked it nearly in the middle of the road, and she was out of it, getting her kids out from the back. And Trish was telling them all how I rolled down the window and called out to her, "Excuse me," exactly like I did to her. I'll never forget it. So the woman, a big girl by the way with a baseball cap, she takes her head out of the back of the Jeep and turns. The way Trish was telling it was fucking brilliant. And we were all in stitches, all ages, you know, kids and oldies, all laughing. So anyway, I ask her, your woman with the baseball cap, I say, "Would you mind moving your car? We're just trying to get out." And your woman just says, "Fuck off. No." "Yeah," said Joe. "That's all. Fuck off." Straight at me. And Trish's face, Davy, when she was saying it, it was the funniest fucking thing. Trish wasn't wearing a cap when she was telling it, but the way she was holding her head, you'd have sworn she was. It was fucking hilarious. But what? She wasn't there. "What do you mean?" "She wasn't in the car. Trish wasn't. I was driving and Holly was beside me. Just me and Holly. I was dropping her off to a football summer camp before I went on to work. She's a great footballer, Holly. All sports, really. But it was June-like, so Holly was done with school, but the girls' school, the primary, was still open till the end of the month. That's why she was with me. But the point is, Trish wasn't there. She didn't witness the woman's performance. I told her later."
Roddy Doyle reading from Love there, who along with Kevin Barry and Christine Dwyer Hickey will be part of Arena's and the Dublin Book Festival special broadcast from Molly, the Museum of Literature Ireland, Friday week, November the 27th. My second appetizer for that event comes from Christine Dwyer Hickey, the author of this year's One City, One Book, with her novel Tatty, which is the story, of course, of a young girl who's navigating a life where both her father and her mother have problems with alcohol. In the interview with Christine at Molly as part of the Dublin Book Festival, I asked her about her hesitance in becoming a writer.
But I did kind of want to be, a writer. It was the one thing I excelled at in school. And I avoided it, I think, for many years because of the writers that I saw when I was growing up. I didn't want that kind of life, you know.
What were you seeing that was
I was seeing that they, particularly with their children and that lack of, I don't know, the chaos. It was always chaotic. And the drinking and the, you know, if somebody asked me when I was 12 what you want to be, I wanted to be something in a uniform and something that was organised, and it might be the woman in Beauties with a little penny and a little notebook for writing down, you know, things and place to put it, or it could be just anybody who was organised. But I didn't want to be someone who, they're always sort of on the piss and fight. They were always fighting at and shouting and, you know, and there just seemed to be an awful lot of unhappiness around writers as well. But even though they probably had a great time themselves, this is just how I saw it as a kid.
Christine Dwyer Hickey there from our interview at Molly. She will be joined by Roddy Doyle and Kevin Barry and singer Uli at this special Dublin Book Festival event Friday, November the 27th here on Arena on RT Radio 1 and in video form online from dublinbookfestival.com, rte.ie/culture. Another event at the Dublin Book Festival is called The Queer Body, a poetry reading and discussion. That takes place on December the 3rd. And joining me now is one of the poets involved and indeed the curator of the event, poet and editor Mark Ward. Just to explain to us, it's yourself, Mark, and Sean Hewitt and Liz Quirk in conversation with Sasha De Boyle. This is a partnership with Kirch International Festival. You curated this event. How did you go about choosing your panel here? What were you looking for?
I think what I was looking for was a good mix of discussion and an overlapping of themes. I've read with Liz before a couple of times, and I love her work, and I was very excited about her new book coming out. And I thought her exposition of queer themes was very different from Sean's, which is very different from mine. So I thought they'd make a good mix. So I talked to Dublin Book Festival about it, and they were on board. And it was very lucky and very delighted that they have Sasha Bull, who's festival director of Kirch Festival of Literature, and she is going to be in discussion with the three of us.
So Liz Quirk's debut collection is called The Road Slowly. What is the focus there?
Liz, The Road Slowly is very much focused on domesticity and motherhood and very much being a wife and mother from a queer perspective. It's an absolutely stunningly beautiful collection, and I'm delighted to have her on board and to read with her once more at this event.
And Sean Hewitt then, who we spoke to on the programme here a while back about his debut collection, Tongues of Fire. Nature very important in Sean's poetry, I think, Mark, and also the way he conveys the emotions, particularly around grief around his father. Very interesting collection.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, very much Tongues of Fire, the queer body is very much seen through nature and seen through the natural world, which is very important nowadays. And eco-poetry is very much becoming a thing. And I think he's very much on the vanguard of that. So it's very exciting to hear him kind of frame his life and experience through those things.
I think it's safe to say that even from the title of your own collection, Carcass, you're probably in a more visceral world. Is that a fair description of the difference between yourself, Sean, and Liz?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a strange little book that I put together. When I was putting it together, it was very much kind of a lot of darker work that sat well together. And I said, sure, why not? Let's embrace it. So I made this book, which is very much kind of a short, sharp shock. And it very much speaks to the queer body in terms of the dangers of it in the modern world, having the fear of the queer body and themes such as like that.
And I suppose fear and maybe looking for people to find a little bit of empathy is what's in your mind around A History of Empathy, which is one of the poems in the book. Maybe would you introduce that for me and read it for me?
Yeah, no, absolutely. A History of Empathy is, like you say, it's looking for empathy and connection, but it's also, at the end of the day, gay men are still men, and some men are a bit rubbish about talking about their feelings and pushing things away. So this poem is very much about that. A History of Empathy. Your emotions are a fog, slowing the car due to low visibility. Their ubiquity dismantling place or movement, leaving only a patch of ground and an obscured map screen. Your emotions are seeping into the room, invisibly increasing the altitude until lungs fill with them, acclimatizing to their reduced capacity. Your emotions have been mapped. They're prehensile and terrifying, burnt into retinas, colouring reality with their retinue. Your emotions are gasping children. One day you will disown.
And that's Mark Ward with his poem, A History of Empathy. And Mark has curated and is part of an event at the Dublin Book Festival, an event called The Queer Body, a poetry reading and discussion. And it will be Mark, Sean Hewitt and Liz Quirk along in conversation with Sasha De Boyle of the Kirch International Festival. There was another poem that I wanted. I can't get you to read it because it's quite a long piece, but I'm interested in the origins of this poem. A poem called Mitko. Mitko Responds is the title of the poem, but maybe tell us where Mitko comes from in the first place and why you felt he needed a chance to respond.
Yeah, no, Mitko is the antagonist and love interest of Garth Greenwell's first novel, What Belongs to You, which I absolutely adored and loved. But he very much fascinated me, the character. It's written from the narrator's voice. He describes him, but Mitko never gets to speak. And that poem is very much trying to reclaim his voice from the narrator and to stamp his own voice on things.
I guess we need to know what Mitko's relationship with the narrator is to know why you felt he needed a chance to have his voice reclaimed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in that novel, it's very much a transactional relationship. Mitko is a prostitute. It's very much the queer body on the fringes in that respect. So I thought it very, his voice was kind of calling out to me to speak his own words.
And now, as well as this event, there's a lot of things going on in your own life. The poet, and then by day, a librarian and also a festival organiser. You're clearly very busy despite lockdown, Mark.
Absolutely, yeah. Librarians never stop. We're all still going, and we've just concluded the ninth edition of the Redline Book Festival. So yeah, a bit tired at the moment, but still going. But yeah, all going. And then I edit I have a queer poetry journal called The Possible Archetype as well, which we're gearing up for the 50 year, which will start early next year. So that's very exciting.
So that journal, just let me give the name of it again. It's Impossible Archetype, an LGBT publication. And you edit that, Mark, do you? Yes.
Yeah, no, it's a journal of queer poetry from all over the world. Mm. And it's their 50 year and 9th and 10th issues of Impossible Archetype this year. And people can submit from the 1st January.
Great. Well, listen, lovely to speak with you this evening. That's Mark Ward and Mark's event, The Queer Body, a poetry reading and discussion, December the 3rd at the Dublin Book Festival, dublinbookfestival.com for full details on that. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy was the researcher. Anne-Marie Dunnan was the broadcast coordinator. Sound supervision this evening was by Tommy O'Sullivan, and tonight's programme produced by Olin McGowan.